low wooden building consisting of a single room. It contained three doors, a few windows, half a dozen tables, and some sagging wooden beds. Outside were two unspeakably foul toilets with a well between. There were no trees, no flowers, no amenities of any kind. But there was a copious amount of red mud, a thicket of wild plum from which firewood could be cut, and in all directions the green wilderness of growing sugar canes. This was the Ishiki camp, so known because of the interpreter who ran it. In this particular camp there were no women, no facilities for recreation, no doctor, and no church. There was lots of rice, for Wild Whip insisted that his men be fed well. And in each camp, for this was merely one of seven on Hanakai Plantation, one man was appointed fisherman, bringing to the table whatever he caught on the fruitful reefs of Kauai. It was Whip Hawksworth's full intention that any laborer whom he imported should work for him 5 or 10 years, save his money, and return to Japan. There was thus no need for women or churches, and little need for doctors, since he hired only the ablest bodied. At Hanakai, the Hawksworth laborers rose at 4 in the morning, ate a hot breakfast, hiked to the fields so as to be there at 6, and worked till 6 at night, hiking back to the Ishii camp on their own time. For this they were paid 67 cents a day, but they did get their food and a sagging bed. During harvest, of course, they worked 19 hours a day for no extra money. On the first workday, Kamijiro Sakagawa marched home at dusk, feeling great strength in his bones, and looked about for some place in which to bathe. For, like all Japanese, he was fanatic in his attention to cleanliness, and he was dismayed to find that no provisions had been made. Water could be pumped from the well, but who could bathe properly in cold water? On this first night, he had to make do, protestingly, and he listened to his mates growling as they recalled the sweet, hot baths of Hiroshima. And that night he went to see Ishii-san and said, "I think I will build a hot bath for the camp." "There's no lumber," Ishii-san said. It was his job to protect the interests of Mr. Hawksworth, and he did so. "I saw some old boards at the edge of the sugar field," Kamijiro replied. "You can have them, but there are no nails," Ishii-san warned. "I saw some nails where the irrigation ditch was mended." "Were they rusted?" "Yes." "You can have them." On his second full day ashore in Hawaii, Kamijiro began building his hot bath. It was most tedious work, for he could not find lumber that fitted, nor could he get hold of a piece of galvanized iron for the bottom where the fire was to be built. At last he grabbed Ishii-san, who was skittish about the whole affair, and made the interpreter speak to Mr. Hawksworth, Hoksuwurtu, as the Japanese men called him, and the tall boss growled, "What do you want galvanized iron for?" "To take a bath," Kamijiro said. "Use cold water. I do," Hawksworth snapped. "I don't," Kamijiro snapped back. And Hawksworth turned in his saddle to study the runty little man with the long arms that hung out from his body. "Don't speak to me that way," Hawksworth said ominously, pointing his riding crop at him. "We have to be clean," Kamijiro insisted, not drawing away from the crop. "You have to work," Hawksworth said slowly. "But after work, we want to be clean," Kamijiro said forcefully. "Are you looking for a fight?" Hawksworth cried, dropping from his horse and throwing the reins to an attendant. Ishii-san, the interpreter, began to sweat and mumbled his words, replying on behalf of Kamijiro, "Oh, no, sir. This man is a fine workman." "Shut up," Hawksworth snapped, pushing his little assistant aside. Striding up to Kamijiro, he started to grab him by the shoulders, but as he did so, he saw the enormous musculature of the stubborn workman, and he saw also that Kamijiro had no intention of allowing even the boss to touch him, and the two men stood in the cane field staring at each other. The other Japanese were terrified lest trouble start. But Kamijiro, to his surprise, was unconcerned, for he was studying the big American and thinking, "If he comes one step closer, I will ram my head into his soft belly." In mutual respect, the tension dissolved, and Wild Whip asked Ishii-san, "What is it he wants?" "He's building a bath for the camp," Ishii repeated. "That's what I don't understand," Hawksworth replied. "Japanese cannot live unless they have a bath each day," Kamijiro explained. "Pump the water and take a bath," Whip said. "A hot bath," Kamijiro replied. For a long moment, the two men stared at each other, after which Whip laughed easily and asked, "So you've got to have some corrugated iron?" "Yes," Kamijiro said. "You'll get it," Hawksworth replied. As if they were boys playing, Whip winked at Kamijiro and chucked him under the chin with the whip. With one finger, the Japanese laborer slowly moved the crop away, and the two men understood each other. When the bath was built, a square tub 4 feet deep on stilts, Kamijiro rigged a triple length of bamboo which delivered water from the pump. Beneath the galvanized iron, he built a fire with wild plum branches, and when the water was hot, he clanged a piece of iron to summon the camp. Each man stripped, hung his clothes on a pole spiked with nails, and was allowed one panful of hot water with which to soap down outside the tub and rinse off. Then, mounting 3 wooden steps, he climbed into the steaming water and luxuriated for 4 minutes. While he was doing this, the next man was cleansing himself, and as the first crawled out reluctantly, the second climbed in eagerly. Kamijiro tended the fire and added new water as it was needed. The first 10 men to use the water paid a penny each and cast lots to determine who had the right to climb in first. After the first 10, each man paid half a cent, and as many as wished used the water. Long after night had fallen, when the pennies were safely stowed away and the other men were eating their evening meal, Kamijiro himself would undress, place one more stick under the iron, for he liked his bath hotter than most, and after carefully soaping himself outside and washing off, he would climb into the remnants of the water. Its heat would encompass him and make him forget Hiroshima and the difficulties of the day. To the east, the casuarina trees kept away the storm, and in the hot bath, all was well. When he returned to his bunk, he invariably looked with deep respect at his only significant possession, the black-framed portrait of the Japanese emperor. Before this grim and bearded leader, the little workman bowed. The one reality in his life was that the emperor personally knew of his daily behavior and was grieved when things went poorly. Each night, before he went to sleep, he weighed his day's actions and hoped that the emperor would approve. In order to collect the firewood needed for the hot bath, Kamijiro rose at 3:30 each morning and worked while the others were eating. When the wood was safely stored, he grabbed 2 rice balls, a bit of pickle, and part of a fish, munching them as he ran to the fields. At 6, when the day's work ended, he dashed home ahead of the rest to get the fire started, and was not free to eat until the last bath had been taken. Then he accepted what was left, and in this way he saved the money for the important step he was to take 13 years later, in 1915. It was not easy to accumulate money, not even when one worked as hard as Kamijiro did. For example, in 1904, events transpired in Asia which were to eat up his savings. But no man worthy of the name would have done less than he did under the circumstances. For some months, Japan had been having trouble with Russia, and the emperor's divine word to his people had reached even remote Kauai, where with trembling voice Ishii-san had read the rescript to all the assembled Japanese. "As it is our heartfelt desire to maintain the peace of the East, we have caused our government to negotiate with Russia. But we are now compelled to conclude that the Russian government has no sincere desire to maintain the peace of the East. We have therefore ordered our government to break off negotiations with Russia and have decided to take free action for the maintenance of our independence and self-protection." "What does it mean?" Kamijiro asked. "War," an older man explained. Now Ishii-san's voice rose to an awed climax as he delivered the distant emperor's specific message to all loyal Japanese. We rely upon your loyalty and valor to carry out our object, and thereby keep unsullied the honor of our empire. Banzai, a former soldier shouted. Japan must win, the workman began to cry. Ishii-san waited for the tumult to die down, then announced, On Friday, an officer of the emperor himself will come to Hanakai to collect money for the imperial army. Let us show the world what loyal Japanese we are. He hesitated a moment, then announced, I will give $11. A gasp went up from the crowd as men realized how much of his meager salary this represented, and another was inspired to cry, I will give $19. The crowd applauded, and as the ante rose, Kamajiro was swept up by the fervor of the moment. Japan was in danger. He could see his parents' fields overrun by Russian barbarians, and he thought how insignificant were his savings from the hot bath. In an ecstasy of emotion, seeing the grave, bearded emperor before him, he rose and cried in a roaring voice, I will give all my bath money, $77. A mighty cheer went up, and a Buddhist priest said, Let us in our hearts resolve to protect the honor of Japan as Sakagawa Kamajiro has done this day. Men wept, and songs were sung, and Ishii-san shouted in his high, weak voice, Let every man march by and swear allegiance to the emperor. Instinctively, the workmen formed in orderly ranks and fell into martial rhythms as they marched past the place where the Buddhist priest stood. Pressing their hands rigidly to their knees, they bowed as if to the august presence itself and said, Banzai! Banzai! When the excitement was over and the emperor's emissary had left with the money, the camp settled down to the agony of waiting for war news. It was rumored that Russian troops had landed on the island of Kyushu, and Kamajiro whispered to Ishii-san at night, Should we return to Honolulu and try to find a boat back to Japan? No, Ishii said gravely. After all, what we have heard is only a rumor. But Japan is in danger, Kamajiro muttered. We must wait for more substantial news, Ishii-san insisted. And because he could read and write, people listened to him. And the year 1904 ended in apprehension. But in January 1905, his prudence was rewarded when word reached Kauai that the great Russian bastion at Port Arthur had surrendered to a Japanese siege. Kauai, that is the Japanese living there, went wild with joy, and a torchlight procession was held through the plantation town of Kapa'a. And the celebrations had hardly ended when word came of an even more astonishing victory at Mukden, followed quickly by the climactic news from the Strait of Tsushima. A Russian fleet of 38 major vessels had engaged the Japanese under Admiral Togo. 19 were immediately sunk, 5 were captured, and of the remaining 14, only 3 got back to Russia. More than 10,000 of the enemy were drowned, and 6,000 taken prisoner. For their part, the Japanese lost only 3 minor torpedo boats and less than 700 men. The Honolulu Mail called Tsushima one of the most complete victories any nation has ever enjoyed at the expense of a major rival. Kamajiro, listening to the stunning news, burst into tears and told his friend Ishii-san, I feel as if my hot bath money had personally sunk the Russian ships. It did, Ishii-san assured him, because it represented the undying spirit of the Japanese. Look at the poor Americans. Their president speaks to them, and nothing happens. No one pays attention. But when the emperor speaks to us, we hear, even though we are lost at the end of the world. Kamajiro contemplated this for a moment, then asked, Ishii-san, do you feel proud today? I feel as if my heart were a balloon carrying me above the trees, Ishii-san replied. I can feel guns going off in my chest every minute, Kamajiro confided. They are the guns of Admiral Togo. Again, tears came into his eyes, and he asked, Ishii-san, do you think it would be proper for us to say a prayer for that great admiral who saved Japan? It would be better if the priest were here. That's his job. But wouldn't it be all right if we ourselves faced Japan and said a prayer? I would like to do so, Ishii-san admitted. And the two laborers knelt in the red dust of Kauai, and each thought of Hiroshima and the rice fields and the red torii looking out over the Japan Sea, and they prayed that their courageous country might always know victory. By this time, Kamijiro had saved, from his wages and the hot bath, an additional $38, and the camp suspected this. So when word reached Kauai that a splendid victory celebration was to be held right in the heart of Honolulu for all Hawaii to see, and that the island of Kauai was invited to send two men to march in Japanese uniforms and play the roles of immortal military leaders like Admiral Togo, everyone agreed that Kamijiro should be one of the men, because he could pay his own way, and a man named Hashimoto was the other, because he also had some savings. And in late May 1905, the two stocky laborers set out on the inter-island boat Kilauea for Honolulu. There, the committee provided them with handsome uniforms, which local Japanese wives had copied from magazine pictures. And Kamijiro found himself a full colonel, in memory of a leader who had personally thrown himself upon the Russian guns at the siege of Port Arthur. This Colonel Ito had been blown to pieces and into national immortality. It was with bursting pride that Colonel Sakagawa lined up on the afternoon of June 2, 1905, to march boldly through the streets of Honolulu and across the Nu'uanu to A'ala Park, where thousands of Japanese formed a procession that proceeded solemnly to the Japanese consulate, where a dignified man in frock coat and black tie nodded gravely. A workman from one of the Janders and Whipple plantations on Oahu was dressed in Admiral Togo's uniform, and from the steps of the consulate he led the banzai, and the formal marching broke up. Kamijiro and his fellow Kauai man, Hashimoto, walked back to A'ala Park, where exhibitions of Japanese wrestling and fencing were offered to an appreciative crowd. But the victory celebration was to have overtones of another kind, which Kamijiro would never forget. For at 10 o'clock, when the crowd was greatest, a pathway was formed, and 8 professional geisha girls from one of the tea houses passed through the confusion to take their places on the dancing platform. And as they went, one walked in her gently swaying manner quite close to Kamijiro, and the powder in her hair brushed into his nostrils, and he admitted, for the first time in 3 years, how desperately hungry he was for that girl Yoko back in Hiroshima. A haze came over his eyes, and he imagined that the mask was once more upon his face while he prepared to slip into her sleeping room. He could feel her arms about him and hear her voice in his ear. The crowd pressed in upon him, but he was not part of it. He was in Hiroshima in the spring, when the rice fields were a soft green. And a horrible thought took possession of him. I shall never leave Kauai. I shall die here and never see Japan again. I shall live all my life without a woman. And he began in his agony to walk among the crowd and place himself so that he might touch this Japanese wife or that. He did not grab at them or embarrass them. He wanted merely to see them and to feel their reality, and his glazed eyes stared at them. I am so hungry, he muttered to himself as he moved so as to intercept a woman at least 20 years older than he. She shuffled along with her feet never leaving the ground, Japanese style, and the soft rustle of her passing seemed to him one of the sweetest sounds he had ever heard. Instinctively, he reached out his hand and clutched at her arm, and the shuffling stopped. The housewife looked at him in amazement, pushed his hand down, and muttered, You are a Japanese. Behave yourself, especially when you wear such a uniform. Mortified, he fled the crowd and found Hashimoto, who said abruptly, Those damned geisha girls are driving me loony. Let's find a good whorehouse. The two Kauai laborers started probing the A'ala region, but a stranger told them, The houses you want are all in Iwilei. so they hurried to that quarter of the city. But the houses were filled with richer patrons, and the two could gain no entrance. "I'm going to grab any woman I see," Hashimoto said. "No," Kamijiro warned, remembering the admonition of the woman he had touched. "To hell with you," the other shouted. "Girls, girls," he shouted in Japanese, "here I come to find you." And he dashed down one of the Iwile alleys. Kamijiro, now ashamed to be in such a place while dressed as Colonel Ito, who had sacrificed his life at Port Arthur, fled the area and returned to the park, where he sat for hours staring at the dancers. This time he kept away from women, and after a long time an old Japanese man came up to him with a bottle of sake and said, "Oh, Colonel, what a glorious war this was! And did you notice one thing tonight? Not one damn Chinese had the courage to appear on the streets while our army was marching. I tell you, Colonel, in 1895 we defeated the Chinese, and in 1905 we defeated the Russians, two of the finest nations on earth. Who will we fight 10 years from now? England? Germany?" "All the world can be proud of Japan," Kamijiro agreed. "What is more important, Colonel," the drunk continued, "is that here in Hawaii people have now got to respect us. The German lunas who beat us with whips, the Norwegian lunas who treat us with contempt, they have got to respect us Japanese. We are a great people. Therefore, Colonel, promise me one thing, and I will give you more sake. The next time a European luna dares to strike you in the cane fields, kill him. We Japanese will show the world." It was a tremendous celebration, worthy of the impressive victory gained by the homeland. And even though it used up much of Kamijiro's savings and reminded him of how lonely he was, he felt it had been worthwhile. But it had one unfortunate repercussion which no one could have foreseen, and long after the celebration itself had faded into memory, this one dreadful result lived on in Kamijiro's mind. It started in the whorehouses of Iwile, after Kamijiro had abandoned his lusty friend Hashimoto to the alleys. For that young man had forced his way into one of the houses and had been soundly thrashed by half a dozen Germans who resented his intrusion. Thrown into one of the gutters, he had been found by a Hawaiian boy who did pimping for a group of girls. And this boy, in the custom of the islands, had lugged the bewildered Japanese home, where his sister had washed his bruises. They had been able to converse only in pidgin, but apparently enough had been said, for when Hashimoto returned to the Kauai ship, he had the sister in tow. She was a big, amiable, wide-eyed Hawaiian who carried with her only one bundle tied with string, but she seemed to like wiry, tough-minded Hashimoto and apparently intended to stay with him. "I am going to marry her," Hashimoto stoutly informed Kamijiro, who still wore his colonel's uniform. And something about either the victory celebration or the uniform made Kamijiro especially patriotic that day. For as soon as his friend said the fatal words, "I am going to marry her," he sprang into action as if he were in charge of troops. Grabbing Hashimoto by the arm, he warned, "If you do such a thing, all Japan will be ashamed." "I may not ever go back to Japan," Hashimoto said. Impulsively, like a true colonel, Kamijiro struck Hashimoto across the face, shouting, "Don't ever speak like that. Japan is your home." Hashimoto was a stunned